The reading for this morning is 1 Timothy 1, 3, verse 3, 3, verse 1 to 13. Here is a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. Now the overseer is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, and able to reach. But he is also not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money, all must not manage their own family well in a manner worthy of full respect. He must not be a recent convert, or they may become conceited, must also have a good reputation with outsiders. And in the same way, deacons are to be worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, and not pursuing dishonest gain. They must keep good hold of deep truths of the faith with a clear conscience. They must first be tested, and then, if there is nothing against them, let them serve. In the same way, female leaders must be worthy of respect, not malicious talkers, but temperate, and trustworthy in everything. A deacon must be faithful to his wife and must manage his children and his household well. Those who have served well will gain an excellent standing and great assurance in their faith in Jesus Christ.
So here is a trustworthy saying. A trustworthy saying. Remember, a couple of weeks ago when we started looking at these letters to Timothy, in that first part, there was a trustworthy saying. And of course, I test you. Who can remember what that first trustworthy saying was? It was about Jesus. Jesus came into the world to save sinners. That was the first trustworthy saying. But now in chapter 3, he introduces another trustworthy saying. We'll find several trustworthy sayings as we work through these two letters. But whilst the first one was about Jesus, and very spiritual, Jesus came into the world to save sinners, this next one is someone who wants to be an overseer, a leader, desires a noble task. Now that's a bit curious, because on one level there's nothing spiritual about that. You could use that same phrase in your local book club. If you needed a leader and someone said, well, I'll step up and I'll lead in the club, you would think, well, that's a noble task. Thank you for taking that on and being leader. It's a secular phrase on one level, nothing special about it. Well, as we get into this chapter, one thing to realise is that it has a structure. And that's why the slides on the screen were presented in a slightly different fashion. Because the structure of this particular passage is one that's frequently used in the Bible. And here's a technical jargon, a nerdy Bible term. The structure is called a chiastic structure. Okay? A chiastic structure. You say that chiastic structure. You see? And what it means is that you've got a verse or a few verses, and then at the end of a passage, you've got some other verses that match, that balance. And then you've got a few more verses, and then you've got mirror image, other verses that match, and then more, and it builds up to a center. So if you go to the next slide, please, Ollie. There's the chiastic structure. So verse 1 balances with verse 13. Verses 2 to 7, they don't have to have exact same number of verses. 2 to 7 balances with verse 12. Verse 8 with verse 11. Verses 9 and 10 form the centre. Those of you who have been here for several years, this should be familiar, because we did show this a few years ago, this same slide. A chiastic structure working in layers to the middle. So the middle, verse 9 and 10, is the heart of what he's trying to say. The other thing to know about this passage is that in verses 8 and 11 in your English translation, you've probably got a word like likewise or also. That's the same Greek word that we had last week, which was in the same way or likewise or also, which, if you remember from last week, acts like a short circuit, a screwdriver across bare electric wires, shorting the whole thing together. So that, in this case, whatever Paul says about overseers, certain type of leader, he's also saying about deacons, and he is also saying about female leaders in the church. So it's like you've got three electric circuits, three bare wires. And these little words, likewise, in verse 8 and 11, are like a screwdriver shorting the three together. So the same principle to all three applies each and every one. And that principle is character, character, character. How people conduct themselves, how they behave, how they are. Leadership relies on character all the way. Notice there's no blueprint in a passage like this for different roles in the church. There's nothing that says, well, if you're going to have a church, then you're going to need a fabric deacon, someone who looks after the buildings. Well, that's because they didn't have any buildings at that stage, so that wouldn't be there anyway. But there's also nothing to say, well, you're going to need a treasurer. There's nothing to say that you're going to need a secretary. There's none of that stuff is listed. But it does say you're going to need people with character. You're going to need people with character. You're going to need people with character. People are respectable. People are faithful in their marriage. People are hospitable, gentle, not quarrelsome, and so on. Now, we know that that makes sense. We know that people ultimately lead by their example and not just by what they say. And we see the kind of counter-examples of that on our news all the time. Just this week with the whole football manager transfer, whatnot, greed stuff. People with out of character, bad character, fundamental greed, cannot be allowed to lead. And we see it, of course, with our politicians and whole character integrity issues all the time. If you don't have good character, then it's going to trip you up. And the leading is not going to be possible down the line. Someone once said that discipleship, our following of Jesus and our ability to teach and help others to follow Jesus, discipleship is caught, not taught. You lead by example, it's caught, it's not taught. And at a conference, Karen and I were at a lady who runs two churches in Loughborough came up with this very good phrase. She said, look, if you are teaching mumps to your people, but you in fact have measles, the people are going to catch measles. Yeah? You can be teaching mumps all you like, sermon after sermon on mumps, but if you in fact have measles, people are going to catch measles. It's caught, not taught. But the character traits that Paul lists through the passage, there's many. Today I want to look at through the lens of honouring people. Maybe not all the traits in the list fit honouring other people, but most of them do. Faithful to your spouse, respect of children, that's about honouring your nearest and dearest. Do you honour them so that they can thrive and be the people that God wants them to be? Being temperate and self-controlled, That's about how you conduct yourself with others, but more importantly, how you do that when you are under pressure. Most of us can be nice to other people when we're in a good place ourselves, but what about when you as leader are under pressure? Are you still able to honour other people? Being hospitable, that's about honouring others by being open and generous, being able to honour the stranger. Remember, we talked about that again a few weeks ago with our new fourth habit, which is margin for Jesus. Margin for Jesus. If you leave no margin for Jesus, you will struggle to honour the stranger because you won't have any margin, any room in your life to do that. So make it a habit of leaving space in your schedule, in your week, in your month, in your year, however it works for you. Leave margin for Jesus. That will give you space where you can honour the stranger and the other person. Being gentle and not quarrelsome, again, is about honouring others. Being sincere, not malicious talkers, being worthy of respect. Well, remember that respect is something that you earn. So in your life of honouring others, you earn for people to be able to honour you. Honouring principle again. But while we're talking about honouring others, I want to slightly depart from the passage for just a couple of minutes and talk about an area where I fear as a culture, as a society now in the West with all our technology and gadgets and stuff, we inadvertently dishonour other people. Because what I've noticed, and this is not just in church, it's outside as well, it's that now we're all flooded with lots of communications, emails, texts and tweets and all the rest of it. We can fall into the trap of not replying to stuff that needs a reply. Now, I'm not talking about just sort of general chit-chat, low-level stuff, but it doesn't really matter whether it gets a reply or it doesn't. And I'm not talking about for your information type emails or when you've copied someone else in just so that they're aware, but it doesn't really matter if they reply or not. I'm not talking about that. And of course, I am not talking about the spam and the just sending out stuff because you can and hitting people with all this stuff. I'm talking about where you're communicating on something that you work together on. And it might be a project at work, it might be in your small group, or it might be a certain aspect of ministry in church life, or it might be some other club that you're involved in. When someone sends something, and really that something ought to have some kind of reply or acknowledgement, but because in the melee of stuff and it hits you at 12 o'clock and you can't get to it till 5 o'clock and all that kind of stuff, you do not reply. The trouble is, when you do that and not reply, you may not realize it, but you are in fact communicating back to the original sender. You're thinking, well, I've not sent a reply, but you are still communicating. And what you are communicating back to the person who sent the message of some importance is that you don't care. And so you dishonour the person who sent it. Now you might be sitting there thinking, well, that's a bit harsh. I do care about that project. And I think the person who sent that email or that message is a wonderful person. I'm fantastic to work with them. They are one of the best people in the church. But I do care. But if you do not reply, implicitly you are communicating, I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant to me. And so you dishonour that person. To rejig it, perhaps put it even more bluntly, you might think that's pretty blunt, but we can go further with this bluntness. Imagine that one of you came to me after the service To talk about a ministry area in the church or a small group that you lead or something. And you found me over coffee and you said, Carl, I need to talk to you about X, Y, Z. And, you know, this stuff going on. So, yeah. And you give me all this information and I'm listening to you, or I look as if I'm listening to you. But then you get to the end of your spiel and I look at you blankly. And then I'll walk off. What would you think about that behaviour? Don't we have a word for that in the English language? Rude? Well, you'd think, I'm dishonouring you. I don't care. I just walked off. The same thing happens with emails and texts that warrant a reply. Like I say, I'm not talking about stuff that is just for information or whatever. I'm talking about stuff that does need a reply because you're trying to organise something. The same thing happens. You might think that's unfair, but let me tell you, I've observed this in the workplace. I've observed this in the church. I've observed this in other clubs, organisations, groups of people. The person who took the trouble to send out the message to try and organise the thing, the meeting, the whatever it is, but then doesn't get a reply, feels ignored, feels dishonoured. It is a real problem. Now, of course, I'm not saying that you must reply to everything the nanosecond that you receive it, because that's not necessary. And it's also not appropriate, because if you're sending an email or a text, then technically, a bit of communication jargon here, you are using an asynchronous communication method, because you don't know when it's going to arrive, when they're going to read it. You accept that in some time in the future they should receive it and hopefully send a reply. So you don't have to reply instantly, but do send a reply. If you email me the night before my morning off, my day off, I don't look at my emails late at night. Discipline of off. I don't look at my emails on my day off. Discipline of off. So if you email me just before my day off, then you won't get a reply until like 48 hours later. But if I read that once I get back to work and I see that, and I think, I can't actually answer that yet, I make it my practice to send a holding reply. Say, yeah, I got this. Can't deal with it yet, but I will get onto it. Just so the person knows that the communication has happened, it's registered, and I respect that and honour the other person. So think about your replying. That's a bit of a side order, gone off the passage a bit, so let's get back to the passage now. I'll get down off my soapbox. Verses 9 and 10 are the centre of this passage. Remember, it's a chiastic structure. It builds to this centre. And what do we find at the centre? Keep hold of the deep truths of the faith. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because what have we said each week that these letters are about? They're about trying to win round people and stop the problem of people who have got the wrong idea, who have departed from the deep truths of faith and are now leading people away from Jesus. So he's saying that when you choose your leaders, make sure you choose those who are deeply rooted in the faith and are not going to veer off in strange directions, as is a problem that we see through the letters. People whose foundations are firmly in Jesus. People whose identity is in Jesus. Because when your identity is firmly rooted in Jesus, your character, your behaviour, that's going to flow from that. It's going to be informed by that. And your ability to lead and teach others is going to come from that. Now, interestingly, in this passage about leaders, there isn't anything about spirituality, which is a bit curious, because you'd think that it'd say, look, choose leaders who show a really clear prayer life, and they've got rhythms of prayer through their life that are plain for all to see. Choose leaders who are really in touch with the scriptures and kind of can use the scriptures and work with the scriptures well. We don't have that. But actually, I think that's right. Because character is fundamental. I've known people who are really spiritual, but have some big character issue. And sooner or later, the character issue undermines the good work that they're doing, even that they can do, being so spiritual. A super spiritual person with a problematic character, sooner or later, people are going to get hurt. Things are going to go wrong. So Paul hits on character, character, character as the main thing. A CEO of a major secular company had a great phrase. She said, hire for attitude, train for skills. Hire for attitude, train for skills. If you can find someone who gets it in their head, their psyche, the way they are, if they really get it, and assuming that they do have capability to be trained, you can then train them up with the skills that they will need to do the job. But if they don't get it in the first place, no matter how skilled they are, it's going to be a problem. Hire for attitude, train up in the skills. And that's true for us as Christians as well. An attitude that comes from a godly character, foundations in Jesus, with a spirituality or an emerging spirituality, developing rhythms of prayer and getting engaged with the scriptures to cultivate that character. And then the potential to learn and to be trained up. Interestingly, verse 2 says, able to teach. But actually, the Greek words there convey also the potential to teach. In other words, not someone who's got it all sorted and can just trot it out pat, but has the potential to grow into that role. But to do that, they themselves will need to be teachable. I remember the Christian leader when I was a student at university saying, there was a few one-liners that I remembered from those days. And he said that the worst thing is someone who is simply not teachable. So it's a disaster because you just can't do anything with them if they are not teachable. You need people who are able to learn. And that fits, doesn't it? Remember when we were back in Mark's Gospel at the beginning of the year looking at discipleship, one of the simple things was about correct and restore. And if you're teachable, you can make mistakes, but Jesus and your friends and the community around you will help correct and restore, and you can learn and grow. Well, at this church, we need leaders. And I have a set of requests, and they go like this. We need men who will step up and take initiative and do, and be kicked so that they do that. And we need women to step up and consider themselves for recognition as deacons at a certain leadership level in our church. The irony is that the women step up and take initiative and do, but don't stand to be deacons. There are guys who really need to take initiative and do, but the guys have stood to be deacons. I wish that would balance out a bit, and we'd have some female deacons and some blokes taking initiative and doing. But there you go, I'll get back off my soapbox again. We are looking for people who can be strategic in their thinking, who can be proactive and take responsibility. I call them SPRs, been praying for SPRs since we got here. And we need people who are pioneers, who will lead us out to new initiatives, new parts of the city, and so on. All of that flowing from a character rooted in Jesus with a spirituality to cultivate that, an openness of what God can do rather than simply, here's my plan. So not asking for much. But we seek God to bring those people. This week's trustworthy saying is someone who aspires to be a leader desires a noble task. As I say, on one level, that is a secular phrase. Maybe Paul picked it up from the secular lingo in circulation at the time. But what's the balancing verse of this structure? Well, it's there on the screen, verse 13. Those who have served well gain an excellent standing and great assurance in their faith in Christ Jesus. That's thoroughly spiritual. That's about serving and not lording. That's about being sure in your faith in Jesus and standing tall in that faith in your service. So verse 1 might sound secular, but verse 13 is thoroughly spiritual. What happens when we put those two verses together? We get something like this. Here is a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be a leader desires a noble task. But if you serve in well, will be a life that stands out, being confident and sure in faith in Christ Jesus. That's something great for other Christians to be influenced by. That's something that other Christians will want to copy and emulate in their own lives. And then towards the end of the passage, it goes on, verse 15, that if the whole body of Christians get that and start living that out, that's a wonderful sight. That gives you pillars on a firm foundation for everyone else to see. So if we can go to the next slide, please, Ollie. Like a temple, the firm foundation and the pillars, but of course not blocks of stone, but lives for the world to see. That's what we want to be about. Let's stand together and pray.